This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Is that really true about Emma Watson?
Yeah.
I'm absolutely true.
Justin just said it in the news. Obviously, it's
Oh, so if
be
it's
true.
In the news, it must be right. No,
I'm just Justin... make it up.
She's not sitting there thinking, hang on, let me think of a figure. I don't know, 20 minutes.
Story.
Let's think of, who could it be?
But is that true that that makes her the highest paid actress?
Well, list was compiled by Vanity Fair, so say Vanity Fair.
Right, so she's more highly paid than Sandra Bullock?
Yes.
Well, I've got nothing. I mean, she's a very fine actress, and I really like the Harry Potter movies. I mean, weren't you surprised to hear that?
The only other woman in the top 20 was Cameron Diaz, apparently.
Really?
Sandra Bullock, not there.
But in terms of what she got paid, or in terms of what her movies made, because the figure that everybody quoted about Sandra Bullock for last year was that she was the highest grossing female movie star of last year, meaning movies that she opened, movies that were starring Sandra Bullock.
It's 2009 earnings, apparently.
Yeah,
that's what
estimated earnings in US dollars.
Well, frankly, if I was Sandra Bullock's agent, I'd be on the phone going, excuse me, how come...
But you're not. You're busy enough plugging that book of yours. George, is someone not turned up? Because George Rani is still doing the sport.
Well, I don't know why I'm still here, to be
honest. You've got no home to go to.
I have got a home to go to, and it's in Leeds. And I had hoped to be on the way there now. I'll be listening with interest at 2:30 when I am driving back to see if you get a sports bulletin.
I can do it. Give me the script.
No. We need to play our Colin Firth thing.
You just want to stop me doing it.
I don't want you to read the sport. That's true. Someone who knows absolutely nothing.
I'm reviewing
sport.
Invictus. It's a rugby film.
Yes,
look forward to that.
The key word there being film, I think. George, Justine, thanks very much indeed. So, as you mentioned, reviews coming up between now and 4:00. Oil City Confidential, the Dr. Feelgood movie. We'd like you to get involved if... because you want to play some Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, well, rather than doing a clip, I'd like to play a little bit off the soundtrack album. So our challenge, which Dr. Feelgood... we can't play the whole track because we're...
This vote has been running on Twitter for a while. Everyone's saying milk and alcohol. With hang on, you can't ask for people's opinion and then just...
No, can I tell you why not milk and alcohol? Because it's not Wilco. It's Jippy Mayo.
From Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, you. No,
good
no,
old
no.
Uncle Jippy.
Yeah, but I think I'm going to have to, because I mean, otherwise,
well,
I'd say
you're
wind
so proud
up.
Of him.
No, I'm going to have to draw a line and say it has to be a Wilco track.
Terms and conditions
apply.
Angus Beatty on Twitter said, "You surely don't need to ask that question," which really isn't very helpful because we just did. Anyway, Invictus will be reviewed. Astro Boy will be reviewed. Eric Schlosser's going to be with us a bit later to talk about his new film, Food Inc.
Inc.
First. Our special guest, Colin Firth, star of Tom Ford's movie A Single Man, which is out next week. And if you were watching online last Friday, you'll know we recorded this interview then, just before Colin's Oscar nomination for Best Actor. Colin Firth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
You're looking particularly slim and gorgeous, can I say?
It's, yeah, this is how I look on the radio.
Well, let's get an independent verification, Dr. Kermit.
Well, I've spent time with Colin before, though he may have forgotten it. We did a couple of on stage in Edinburgh, and he looked particularly slim and gorgeous then. It's not that he scrubbed up specially for you. I'd hate you to think that this was for your benefit. Incidentally, you're being a bit of a crawler.
I am being a bit of a crawler. Well, if you go and see A Single Man, which stars Colin Firth, you will see the proof of the pudding.
Listen, bless you, and I'm not used to this from either of you, so, you know... Bring it on. I'm not jaded. It's not going, you know, anywhere near my head. So.
Well, in that case, can we just cut straight to the chase and say, in A Single Man, where did you get those glasses and where can I get a pair? Because they were the coolest glasses I've seen, even since David Morrissey. Even cooler than David Morrissey and Bill Nighy.
They're one of the few things that I will take some credit for in that film.
They're yours.
Well, they weren't, but I found them in a props box.
Wow.
And you would think that given Tom Ford's history and for what he designs, which is basically known for eyewear as much as anything else, that this would be de rigueur in a Tom Ford film, that you'd have to have cool glasses and that he would provide them and that they have designed them. That wasn't the case. These were genuine antiques and they weighed a ton, by the way. I mean,
they're made of ivory or something.
Slightly sweaty. They were made of tungsten or something. And they just fell off my nose all the time. And so, you know, it just created a little bit of double-sided. But I found those. And actually, I was the one who wanted the look, you know. Film directors are very loath to let you wear glasses. There are all sorts of reasons they give. I mean, there's a very prosaic and obvious one, which is... they reflect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the DOP doesn't like it very much because it creates a headache for him where he sets his lights. And then there are other people who say, no, it creates a barrier to, between the viewer and your soul, you know. And I don't think that's true. I think glasses look great in films, and I tend to think actors often look like they're much better actors when they're wearing them. So I wanted them for those reasons, and they just were cool, and they went with the hair and the whole of the rest of the look. So I picked them up, put them on, said, well, maybe for reading. He let me wear them for a couple of scenes, and he warmed to them as we went along. So this was not his... almost everything else, I would say, it was initiated by him, but not that.
It occurs to me we're a few jumps ahead here. We're talking about your glasses, where we haven't actually talked about the film, who you are in the film, what the story of the film is, etc.
And indeed who Tom Ford is, because it is possible that, like me, I had never heard of him before I saw the film, so I didn't know who he was.
OK, so now Colin Firth explains the idea behind A Single Man and who Tom Ford actually is.
Right. Well, where should we start?
Come on, it's hardly a tricky question.
It's a very tricky question if you're me. And
it's based on a story by Christopher...
By Christopher Isherwood. It's from a novel by Christopher Isherwood. It takes place in a single day. And we begin with a man waking up and going through what, in the Isherwood story, is actually slightly equivocal in terms of its ending. And I don't want to spoil the ending of the film. It may or may not be his last day alive. Tom's conceit, which was not in the book, is that he's decided to kill himself. He's a gay man, he's a professor. The year is 1962, the setting is Los Angeles, and he wakes up in a state of desperate misery, and he's very meticulously planned that this will be his last day. He's going to tie up some ends, he's going to deliver his last lecture, he's going to clean out the safe deposit box, write some letters, see his old friend, and then do it. And as the day goes on and progresses, there are all sorts of things that happen to interfere with his plan, which are basically to do with his perception of things. And I suppose the most the simplest way to put it is to say that because he's seeing things for the last time in his own mind, they appear to him in a completely new and resonant way.
And just explain why he is suicidal.
He's grief-stricken. His partner died in a car accident. We would probably put that about 7 or 8 months before this story takes place. And we have flashbacks to that. And so, you know, we get enough information, I think, about that relationship for us to invest in emotionally.
And so, and part two of that question was, who is Tom Ford?
Well, Tom, I didn't know much about Tom Ford either. I'd started to hear his name mentioned, particularly with reference to the glasses, because he does do very, very cool glasses. And those glasses, by the way, he's launched a range. Sorry to digress into this.
No, please.
No, he's launched a range of glasses now that are based on those. They're not quite the same. They may suit you better than they suit me. But anyway, have a look.
I think that's hard to imagine. No, are they called Colin Firth in a single man glasses?
Well, they might be called George Falconer glasses. I think there's a George Falconer suit out there. Anyway.
£950 to you, Mr. Kermode, sold.
Yeah, thank you. In that case, I'm staying with the Boots Eyewear range. Anyway, so...
Yes, I mean, I can afford, you know, a lot of things. I mean, I've got a mortgage, but I have a perfectly nice house. I cannot afford Tom Ford's glasses and, you know, cufflinks.
So the thing he's famous for, which again, if some people don't know, is he was the guy who effectively revitalized Gucci.
Apparently, in so doing, revitalized the fashion industry. The people who know about the fashion industry tell me this. I don't know why or what that means. But Gucci was on the rocks, and he came in and apparently completely turned it around. And it was considered to be an extraordinary miracle of not only design skill, but management and just basically how to run a business like that. He's also got a considerable reputation as a photographer, very well deserved one. I mean, he's a brilliant photographer. He's the only time. I mean, I've been photographed a lot, and the results vary wildly. And it takes a very skilled, I have to say, despite your gorgeous compliments earlier, it does take a skilled photographer to really kind of, you know, bring out the best, and I can look pretty bloody awful just by virtue of a change of angle. Tom will take about 5 shots. You get some very neurotic photographers who want to work with you all day, a little bit to the left, tilt your head to the right, and all this sort of thing. Tom will take about 5 shots, and he's got it. And you look at them, and you can't believe it's you. You don't know where or why, or you don't know where the light came from. It's just a sort of miracle. So he has all those skills. But he's never made a film before. And I opened up my email one morning and just saw Tom Ford. And I'd never given him my email address. And I had met him very, very briefly at events on a couple of occasions. But not enough to feel I knew him or anything about him.
He'd been stalking you or something?
Yeah, well, he might have been. He smouldered at me and in a slightly intimidating way. And he is a bit intimidating. He'll make you feel you want to scrub up. I mean, you're a fairly dapper gentleman.
God bless you.
But you get a kind of... your hand goes to twitch your tie and it goes to your hair.
No, there's nothing wrong with my hair. I don't care who's in. My hair is fine.
Do you know what? I think your hair is magnificent.
Thank you, Colin.
And I wondered... I didn't know what you were going to think of this film. And when I thought of the look of the film and then I thought of your hair... I thought maybe there'll be sympathy.
And then you put the glasses on and you knew we were into Buddy Holly territory and everything was fine.
Because everything does look fantastic, does it not? I mean, the look of this film, I think everybody is saying, I mean, it is extraordinary.
Well,
and your house is unbelievable.
It is. And I think they were all, as you can imagine, they were meticulously chosen by Tom. That's his sensibility, that's how he thinks, that's what he's about. And in some ways, I think he's been had up for it a little bit. You know, there are people who say that they find themselves to be all too aware of the style. I think that's partly to do with knowing who he is. Obviously, it doesn't apply to you, but I think he has baggage, and I know all about that. You know, I think they think, fashion designer, let's check out the clothes. Yes, sure enough, they look amazing, and they're all perfect. They would look like that, wouldn't they? And I think, from my perception, it's far more integrated than that. I mean, for a start, George Falconer's fastidiousness and obsession with his sartorial perfection and the way he goes is actually a product of desperation. I mean, that's certainly how it felt like when I did it. That's how Tom directed the film. He didn't come in lambasting us with verbal instructions and trying to manipulate the performance. I came and I looked at the house and I got it. I thought, this is a lonely place. It would have been wonderful when your partner was here. There is the cosy wooden panelled bit with the fireplace, and then there's the big glass exposed bit. And if you're on your own, you're really going to feel it in that place. So it's not just to do with the elegance. I think it tells a story of this guy. You know, on a day you're going to kill yourself, the fact that you shine your shoes and do your shoelace and make your hair perfect and put your tie pin on and your cufflinks, that's a sign of a man who's hanging on by his fingernails.
I think that sequence is one of my favourite bits in the film. It takes George Falconer a long time to become George Falconer, doesn't it? To sort of dress up.
Well, you interrogate Tom on that, because there's a lot of him there. It's not Isherwood's character. It certainly doesn't describe me. And Tom has said that when he's having a bad day, or he's had a bad day, or he has to face something that troubles him, that's when he takes even more trouble over making sure he's perfectly put together. That's what
it's like armor.
It is. It's a body. It's body armor.
But also, I mean, that does. I mean, you know, for cinema fans, that calls to mind things like, you know, American Gigolo, in which there is the sequence in Richard Gere puts out all the clothes, which are the stuff that he's going to put on to become that character. And again, the idea is that he does it because there's nothing else behind it. And this is, he exists entirely on the surface, and you get that sense of hollowness about it.
I think that's right. I think it speaks of a complete and utter vacuum, or worse, actually, chaos. I think his world is a desperate and out of control one. So he has to put a mask on to hide that as he goes through his day. But at the same time, he's putting up a barrier against things coming in on him. He doesn't want to let anything or anyone in. So it's a two-way protection. In that respect, it also, I mean, you can think of a more recent example of something like American Psycho. You know, this man has the unspeakable impulses, but yet he's absolutely fastidious about how he goes about it, how he relates to the human race.
Because the best thing American Psycho is the point at which you know he's mad is the point at which he says that Genesis got better after Peter Gabriel left, and then you know that the man is a psychopath.
The whole thing's going to spiral out of control.
Colin Firth is our special guest. A Single Man is his new film, and you are. The film, Colin. I mean, obviously, we need to mention Julianne Moore and Matthew Good and Nicholas Holt, who are all in this film, but you carry this film. This is your film.
It was
from
start
to finish.
It was a lonely experience. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to be given that opportunity. I mean, I've drawn some very lucky cards in terms of being employed over the last 20 or so years, but they haven't always been the career I would have dreamt up for myself. I've taken what I've been given. Sometimes something wonderful pops up, and the rest of the time I go back to a bit of a sort of journeyman status, and it's, you know, it, it's great to be sort of nearing 50 and to be given probably more meat on the bone than I've ever had. Not in terms of a chance to show off flamboyant stuff. This isn't, you know, a chance to speak Mandarin and walk with a limp and, you know, act with, you know, a disability and get all the awards.
Is that in the extras? I missed that. That would have been quite good.
Well, you know, that's the career in a parallel universe, and I haven't given up on it. But, no, just in terms of playing to whatever strengths Tom perceived me to have and just to kind of put a camera on me and let me go. I'm not the most demonstrative actor in the world. And so if you can put a camera close enough.
Except, I don't know whether you know this, had he seen Trauma? Because, funnily enough, that is the film previously in your career is as close in terms of it's all on one character, it's all about your set, it all goes on in the mind of that. And I know Trauma wasn't as well received as it should have been and was probably very little seen, but actually there is a precedent in that, and that's all very, it's, you know, it's a film which takes place in your character's head.
That's exactly right, and it was a comparison which occurred to me, but as you say, the person who saw Trauma was you.
I saw it twice.
And I've been forever grateful to you for championing that film, and actually Mark Evans, who I seriously consider to be the most underrated British director. I mean, I think he's extraordinary talent, and you know, I'd love to see more of him, and I'd work with him every time. So there is a precedent, and actually, as far as I was in terms of what I invested in it and how much I cared about it, they're on a par completely.
Yeah.
And that is territory that I enjoy and that I feel comfortable in, and you know, that I feel that's where I'm probably at my strongest. To deal with the interior world of somebody, particularly in the wake of grief, don't know where that comes from. I haven't really suffered that kind of loss, really, not on the level that these characters have. To have that put in my lap at this time in life. Also, that strange feeling of being the only actor. I mean, on Trauma, I sort of, you know, I was standing next to the director of photography and the director all day, you know, participating in whatever decisions got made, because I was a guy on his own, so there were no mates in my department. And on Single Man, the days when Julianne came in, which were just two nights, we shot that scene.
The whole thing was done in two nights?
Yeah, she had a three-night commitment. I think she had some other things to do, putting on the makeup and the phone calls and stuff like that. That scene we shot in two nights.
Wow.
Yeah.
And please tell me that she is every bit as fantastic as I assume her to be.
Absolutely, she is. She will exceed your expectations. And well, this sounds like lovey gushing now, and I would say that, wouldn't I?
You know? Well, no, I have to. I wrote a book in which I cast, you know, people from my life as actors, and I cast her to play my wife, because there was no higher compliment. I think she's fantastic.
I don't think you could go wrong with her as your wife. She's one of those people, as far as I'm concerned, the relationship hit the ground running. We knew the same people.
Yeah.
That often helps, you know, people we both like a lot. So we'd both been talked up by our friends. And it was a relationship, it was actually silly. She has no pretense. She's extremely bright. We both talk a great deal. And we just started talking the day we met, and we didn't shut up until she left. And it was one of those things where actually the camera rolling got to be a bit of an interruption.
But the character that she plays gets to say one of the most significant things in the film, which is that she talks about the fact that your character and her character did have a relationship at some point in the past before your character realised that actually wasn't where his affection truly lay.
Mm.
And she says in a completely misjudged moment, well, that wasn't a real relationship, was it? Because it's in a period in which gay relationships were not seen as real. And there are other little things like the fact that your character isn't invited to the funeral of his partner. It's a world in which somehow being partnered to somebody of the same gender just didn't actually have any validity at all.
That's absolutely right. But I think what's interesting about this, the approach to the way George is characterised, both by Christopher Isherwood and by Tom, and certainly in the way I played it, was that this man is completely and utterly comfortable with his sexuality. You know, Isherwood does not write about characters who are wrestling with homosexuality. You know, it's absolutely just taken for granted, to the point where you can't believe it's not just mainstream. And, and so that in some ways that the lack of acceptance by the outside world is even more shocking, because it just, you know, if for anybody out there who thinks that there's a reason to marginalise gay people or that there's anything unnatural about other people's sexual orientation, it doesn't make sense when you see George, as Isherwood's written him. And you know, Tom says that he himself doesn't define himself by his sexuality. You know, he doesn't. If you asked him 10 things about himself, he'd tell you he's from Texas. He'd tell you about his fashion history. He probably wouldn't include the fact that he's a gay man before he got to 10.
Well, is there an extent to which it's not really a very gay film anyway, if that's a valid phrase? It's actually a film about grief and loss and being on your own, as well as anything else.
Well, that's exactly, yes, that's right. And I think it's the fact that he's gay, it's not ignored. It may do something to add to his isolation for the reasons that you give, Mark. And I don't think, though, that it's not an issues film. It's not leaning on those problems. I mean, you could arguably substitute the fact that he's not invited to the funeral for an unmarried relationship in a conservative family. It doesn't depend entirely on that. I will point out one thing that was very, very ironic, you know, because we look back on the dark times of the 60s when people were bigoted and there was no one, you know, and unenlightened and all the rest. The day I shot the scene where the phone call comes in and says, your lover's dead, you can't come to the funeral, was the day that Prop 8 got passed in California, which was the legislation basically withdrawing the rights of gay marriage. And that's been spreading through the states. Mm-hmm. And you sort of think, you know, we have got no right to patronize history. You know, perhaps we haven't come as far as we think we have.
A word on Nicholas Holt. Who we've spoken to on this program before. He's very ugly, isn't he? He's good, though, isn't he?
He's up for a BAFTA. He's up for a Rising Star BAFTA. You, of course, are up for an award as well.
I wish him everything. I mean, he's the loveliest guy. And when you see somebody of that age who I think has that degree of talent, he has such a complex quality. You know, on the screen, it's a genuine performance. This Kenny that he plays, the guy he plays, is not like him at all. There's, you know, he's quite close to the book, actually. I mean, his character is a bit confusing for us all. We're not quite sure what he's up to and what he's after. It verges on creepy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the young man stalking the old guy. Why? Does he want to save him? Is it morbid fascination? Is he just sort of kind of messed up hippie who's taken too much mescaline and thinks the teacher's got some kind of strange wisdom? Is it sexual? You know, it's very difficult to nail what he's after, and I think Nick has that kind of strange ambiguity.
I'd be interested to know what you think of some of the press comments. We've been very, very favourable, and there's award talk and all that kind of
Nominations.
Award nominations. Well, that counts as award talk, doesn't it?
Well, I think a nomination is more solid than a talk.
Okay. There's nomination and there's talk about where those nominations may go. Maybe the nomination will become a solid award.
And then it will become a thing.
Then it will become a thing. But some people have been saying, Colin Firth, a career-defining performance from Colin Firth. And it was at that point, I think, well, you've already defined your what you do very clearly, haven't you? I mean, you must have seen that. What do you think when you see a career defining performance? Clearly, it's a compliment, but do you agree with it?
Well, no, you can't. You actually, that's for other people to do. That's for people can write make their appraisals and draw their conclusions as we go along. My obituary is sitting in a drawer somewhere, you know, ready to have the final paragraph added to it. I mean, that's how it works, and it'll be modified hopefully. And I suppose that you hope as your life goes on that your obituary will get more exciting and it'll get spiced up a bit, and then they'll say, well, we thought he only added up to this, but actually we've discovered he's got this and that up his sleeve as well. So for me, the definition, I hope, is a work in progress, you know.
But when you see it, when you were in it, I mean, did you think, this is great, you know, this is, I haven't done anything like this before?
I don't know. I looked at it and thought, I felt I had done it before. You know, whether it's in things like trauma or whether you have to go back further to, I don't know, things like tumble down or sure, things yeah. that were not associated with what I'm now so completely associated with. And it's not because...
What would that be, Colin?
Well, you know, you tell me.
Well, no, actually, the answer to that is that thing that Mark Evans said, which was that the way that he was going to sell trauma was to call it mad, actually. Because, you know, but that was the whole point, was that you'd always done that other stuff, but obviously people knew, you know, Love Actually and Bridget Jones and you know,
that's
where
I've seen you before.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
And I mean, St. Trinian's, for which I have forgiven you.
Have you?
Well, the second one was better.
Was it? Yeah. I haven't seen it. Yeah. I don't know.
You saw the first one?
I did see
the first one. The first one was hideous beyond belief, but the second one was better.
No, I read this, actually. I think it was an interview with David Tennant where he asked you what you thought of it, and you said it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me.
But the second one was better.
Good. Oh, well.
Yes, if you keep going on, if you make five, it'll be almost adequate by the time you get
I'm sure he's really reassured now.
Yeah, good.
No, we have parted company now.
Have you?
I think they've decided that Jeffrey Thwaites has run his course, yes. That's the character I play, interestingly. Yes. No, so, I mean, we're getting down into sort of too much earnest territory about it and special pleading and all the rest of it. But basically, you know, commercial success is a double-edged coin. What's the message?
Sword.
You know, it gets you employed. It's not a commodity you can ignore, you know. You have to get hired before you can ply your trade. I mean, it's, you know, I like working and I like collaborating and I like, you know, just being active. And I actually like doing silly comedies as well. I enjoy them. I like light entertainment. I like seeing the effect that Mamma Mia has on people, not on everybody. I know there are some people who are... Are you an apologist?
I like Mamma Mia. I think it's so terrible, it's brilliant.
Well, I just think...
And I've seen it three times.
I'm not going to sort of do it. I actually think it's very skillfully made, actually, and I've seen it more times than you. So there.
I disagree with you, but I still like it. I still enjoy it.
I know there are some people whose toes will curl at the very sound or thought of it. And, you know, I loved going to various different cities around Europe and seeing people sitting there skeptically, ready to reject the whole thing, and then the shoulders start to move, and seeing people on their feet. I think that is as important as reducing people to tears or horrifying them or shocking them or revealing something about human nature or whatever, and that gives me great satisfaction. As it happens, those sorts of films have had far more profile than trauma. Yeah. And things like that. So it's not that I've necessarily spent more time prancing around in sequins. It's just that people have noticed it more when I do. So I don't know. You know, as I said, it's going to be for other people to decide what defines what I do. But as far as I'm concerned, I can't, you know, my experiences don't really, they're not consistent with what you see or what the perception is, I don't think.
We're actually out of time, Colin, but what do we see you in next? What is catching your eye? What will we see you in after A Single Man?
The King's Speech, just finished. It's about George the VI.
And you are George.
I'm George the VI. He had to overcome a stammer. A very, very severe stammer in order to be able to do his job. He wasn't supposed to be king. This is what when we were filming it, we called it history's B plot, if you like. It was Wallace and Mrs. Simpson's the A plot, and that's the one we all know about. This is the poor guy in the shadows who wasn't groomed for it. And he was he was not just a speech impediment, he was also a very, very shy man. This is actually about, this focuses on the relationship between him and his speech therapist, who was a very unorthodox Australian called Lionel Logue, and it developed into a friendship, and it's been a fascinating process, actually, because no one really knows what was said between those two men, or did know, until we found the diaries. We came across
Lionel Logue's. Production found the diaries.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, the director, somebody went around looking up Logue in the phone directory until he found someone that said, yes, I'm his grandson. And actually, yes, I have the diaries, and here's all the things they said, and here's the quotes and the dialogue. So we've just nicked all that and stuck it in our script.
And does the king wear nice glasses for Mark to have something to look at?
I don't think you're going to go for the look this time.
Would you steal me that pair of glasses and just slip them to me in a brown paper bag?
Oh, you're so basic.
No, but seriously, because obviously I'm not going to be able to put you. Just
you're going to meet Tom, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to say hi. I met Colin. He said I can have those glasses.
All right.
I'm going to tell him that you said that.
All right.
Colin Firth is the star of A Single Man. And Colin, it's always good to have you on the programme. We appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much. Colin Firth speaking to us last week, just before he got the Oscar nomination. But you have met Tom Ford now.
I have.
How did it go? And did you get the glasses?
No, but oddly enough, he was very slightly chippy on that issue, because I said, Colin Firth said to me that he chose those glasses. They were his. And Tom Ford said, well, we put three sets of glasses in front of him, and he chose one. So there was a very interesting kind of authorial thing going, because Colin Firth's whole point was, it's funny that Tom Ford, you know, obviously is the fashion guy and he does glasses, so it's funny that they were my choice. Well, Tom Ford said, no, they were his choice from three that I pre-selected that I put in front of him. I didn't push it any further than that, but I thought it was interesting.
Glad we got that clear. So coming up before 4 o'clock, who knows what order it's going to come in, because Eric Schlosser's got an issue with the car. Anyway, Eric Schlosser will be here.
It's in Vancouver.
Well, Vassos, this is a surprise. Are we going to get a random selection of favourite sportscasters throughout the afternoon?
It's like the old days.
It is a bit like the old days, yeah. I mean, this is my only sports bulletin. I think you've got Andy May for the rest of the
afternoon.
He's coming
in later,
a little bit of confusion in the sports deck. He's in now, and it will be him for the rest of the day.
Because actually, you're just back from Australia, of course. You're looking lovely, and Tanya, you only popped in to pick up a few things, and there you are.
Read a bulletin.
Yeah, in you go.
Well, it's nice to have you on the show.
Lovely to be here.
Were you in Australia sorting out the plagiarism case?
If you want to utterly baffle Vassos, yeah. I think you just
that couldn't have gone much further over my head. The plagiarism case, and then that little bit.
He's
of
talking
music.
About men at work down under being found to have used kookaburra as part of the flute solo.
Yes.
Would that I was there to sort that out.
I think I'd have done a good job.
Yeah.
Anyway, good thing to throw at Vassos then, Mark.
Look, you do the sports stuff, and me, I don't know what you're talking about, so it's very nice for once to have the upper hand, since you didn't let me read the sports bulletin, which they would have let me read had you not turned up.
Yeah. On the basis that you know nothing about...
No, but I do know that kookaburra doesn't sound nothing like Men at Work.
I think we should ask Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, working on Food, Inc. It's his new film. Do you know what we're talking about, Eric?
I know Men at Work.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what song was plagiarised.
What's the only Men at Work song that anyone
it's
knows?
It's that one, huh?
Down that one.
Mm. The idea being that the flute...
It's so disillusioning.
The flute bit is based on Kookaburra Sits on the Old
the
Gun
Tree.
The
flute bit, which goes...
Eric didn't come in for this kind of nonsense.
No, but it's all registering as I think about the one great song they had was not their song.
Well, no, overwhelmingly it was. It was just that flute solo bit that they've now got to reform and earn a bit of money to pay it back.
It's a bittersweet symphony.
On no other show do you get Eric Schlosser talking about Men at Work and various legal court cases in Australia. How you doing, Eric?
Very well, thank you.
Food, Inc. Is the new film in which you are... I mean, you're in it. You're one of the kind of reporters, you're the investigator, and you're a co-producer. Just explain what you've done here.
Well, it started out almost 8 years ago after Fast Food Nation came out. I found a director, Robbie Kenner, and worked with a director to do a documentary based on it. And in the years of trying to raise money for it, it evolved into a film that looked at all kinds of aspects of the food system that I wasn't able to in my book. So there's another American writer, Michael Pollan, who's written about food issues, whose work is also explored. And then Robbie, the director, took it in all new directions. It's really looking at industrial agriculture and its impact on the people who eat the food, the livestock who are raised by it, and the environment.
And we should mention, because we did with Colin Firth, that he is Oscar-nominated, of course, for his role as A Single Man, as indeed is this film.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a huge honor. There are so many documentaries released every year, and so many good ones, and we made the cut for the top five. And the director, Robbie Kenner, it's really his film, and he's been making documentaries for many years, and I think this is a great honor for him.
Do you expect people to go and see this film in the cinema?
It was very successful in the United States in the cinema. It's very difficult now for any independent film, let alone a documentary, to find distribution. But we were able to get distribution in the States, and I think it was the highest grossing or one of the highest grossing documentaries of the year in theaters. And thanks to Oprah Winfrey, who featured it on her show last week in the United States, we actually became the number one DVD in the United States. Oprah really liked the film, and when she likes something in America, it has a huge impact.
Oprah is rapidly becoming the most important film pundit in the States, because it's because of her that Precious
and book pundit.
No, I know, but she's been a book pundit for ages and ages. But the moving into the suddenly, you not only read that book, but you ought to see this film because Oprah said, it seems to have become a really big thing.
Well, I mean, again, our film Food Inc. had done very well on DVD. It had done well in the theaters, but within, I think, an hour or so of her strongly recommending it on her show and doing a segment on it, it went beyond Twilight and the Michael Jackson DVD, and so that's very gratifying. And I'm not saying everyone has to see this film because it's the greatest film ever made, but I do think it deals with an important subject that we all confront three times a day, which is the food that we eat. I try very hard in my own work, and I think the film does, not to tell people what to eat. I mean, I think you should make up your own mind, but I think it's very important that people know what they're eating. And this is exactly what the big agribusiness companies don't want you to know.
And bearing all that in mind, must be very gratifying for you when you get the publicity of the Oscar nomination and Oprah Winfrey, so that people see your film. Because the whole premise, as you said, the whole premise of what you're suggesting here is that this is the way food is made and no one wants you to know about it.
Right.
So if people are finding out about it, you must feel very revolutionary and subversive at the moment.
It feels pretty good. And one of the reasons that it took from 2002 until 2009 to get this film completed is that the very big companies really didn't want the film to be made and were not cooperative in any way. And the filmmaker had to use all kinds of guerrilla filmmaking tactics to get his cameras into these plants and to get his cameras to show you some of these operations. So going up against big, mean, powerful corporations and
Eric Schlosser is here, the Oscar-nominated Food Inc., it sounds good, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Change the title to that, the Oscar-nominated Food Inc.
We had to put Mark's question on pause, but here it is, and it's going to be worth waiting for.
Because you were saying that the companies didn't want to cooperate. Did they not want to cooperate because of your involvement? Because one of the things, for example, that Michael Moore said is that the minute people hear the name Michael Moore, they go, right, not having anything to do with that. And, of course, he makes great play in Capitalism, a love story of turning, and people just see Michael Moore coming. Was the fact that your name was attached to this the thing that flagged up the fact that they didn't want to be involved? Or are they just pathologically secretive anyway?
I won't claim that it was me at all. I think that what you have to understand about these companies is they are determined to control the flow of information. And there's certain information that's potentially very damaging to them. That is how they produce their food. So they don't distribute photographs or images of how they produce the food, and they don't want anyone else to. So it's much more about power and about control. And quite honestly, I'm not, and I have a great admiration for some of the things Michael Moore does, but I'm a very different kind of writer. I'm not trying to get in their face. I'm not trying to condemn them as being evil. And I think the film would have been better if they had agreed to participate, because it's more interesting when it's a complex point of view. I'm not a big fan of Walmart. Walmart participated in the film. Some people who see the film agree with Walmart's point of view.
And the guy from Walmart is very good. I mean, he puts his point over very well.
Well, I disagree with him completely, but at least he gets his point of view out. As a writer, I think things that are complex are much more interesting than things that are simplistic and telling you what to think. And I'm sorry that the meatpacking companies and the big Monsanto, the big GMO company, refuse to have anything to do with this. These companies are far more likely to try to sue you than to agree to talk to you, and that reflects their mentality.
You've seen this, which is the Monsanto release, in which it says that the film demonizes American farmers and the agricultural system, presents an unrealistic view of how to feed a growing nation, disregards the fact that multiple agricultural systems should and do coexist. And then it has a questionnaire. It says, and it's, have you seen this question, 1 of 7, true or false, Monsanto did not decline to participate in the film Food Inc. My assumption is that their answer to therefore is therefore that that's false, but I don't know. You're saying that they absolutely...
It's a strange way of phrasing that question.
Monsanto did not
decline.
That's so...
Isn't that bizarre?
Bizarre. They declined to participate in the film, and this must be old propaganda of theirs. It is. It's old propaganda, because literally 2 weeks ago, the chief executive of Monsanto said he now regrets not having been part of the film. You have to keep in mind, one of the things we look at in Food Inc. is how Monsanto threatens farmers with lawsuits if they're caught with any residual of GMO seeds in their fields. And the GMO, you know, may have blown into their field through the wind. And the whole segment of Food Inc. about Monsanto is how Monsanto is crushing farmers in the United States. So this propaganda of theirs, that they are the best friend of farmers, it's literally Orwellian, this.
So they're not
farmers in farmers in America are in fear of Monsanto because Monsanto controls over 90% of the soya crop through its patents and about 60-70% of the maize crop in the United States. And if you're a farmer, there are very few other places where you can effectively buy your seeds. So the notion of Monsanto as the friend of the farmer is ridiculous.
And and obviously they're not here to put their side of it. And as indeed,
I'd love if they were.
They're not in your film to put their side of it. One issue, there's a phrase that one of your guests says in the film, Eric, and I can't remember what the context is, but you use the phrase preaching to the convinced. Mm. And I wrote it down because I wonder if the people who go and see this film, that's exactly what you're doing. You're preaching to people who already have concerns about food and farming and so on. And actually, you need to be talking to other people.
Yeah.
How do you go against that?
I disagree with the argument. I think that the film is very accessible. And I think film is a medium. You know, I wrote the book Fast Food Nation, which has been a bestseller, et cetera. But a huge multiple of people have already seen the film in the United States than will ever read one of my books. The film is going to be broadcast on television in the United States. There are foundations that are buying tens of thousands of the DVD and distributing them in the schools. And I think that film and television can have a real impact. I think that Jamie Oliver in this country, on the issues that he's chosen, like school lunches and on chicken, overnight has had an impact. The film End of the Line has had an impact. I'm so much more interested in exposing this to people who may disagree with some of it. And again, it's not as though the film is preaching a very narrow line of how you should live or what you should eat. In a way, it's giving you the information to make the decision for yourself. And in the absence of this sort of film, the only information you have is the information controlled by a handful of very powerful companies who aren't giving you the full story.
It's an American film about American farmers, about American companies,
yeah,
and about American regulators.
Yeah.
Do the issues that you raise in this film, does it still work in Britain with British law,
yeah,
and European law? Is it the same kind of film, the same kind of message you want to get over?
Well, I would love to tell you that the film is a critique of the United States and it's worth seeing only because of its criticism of the United States. But very sadly, the same issues that are dealt with in the film in the United States are very much British issues. And in some ways, you can see this film as a preview of coming attractions. You have not gone as far down the road as we have on this industrialized agriculture centralized system, but you're going the same path. I mean, in the film, we show this Smithfield ham plant in North Carolina that looks like something out of a science fiction film. And you don't have anything like that right now in Great Britain, but they've opened them in Romania. They've opened them in Poland as a way of shipping this meat throughout the EU. You've blocked GMOs thus far in Great Britain, but Monsanto and the other genetically modified seeds,
yeah,
but Monsanto and the other seed companies are now arguing here that if you oppose genetically modified foods, what you are doing is going to cause starvation in the world because we need this genetically modified foods in order to eat, which I think is a total crock. So many of the issues like obesity, and I saw a few McDonald's in London as I was driving on the way over here. The film is about how the system has impacted America, but this really could be Great Britain in another 3 or 4 years.
But there was an interesting case that with McDonald's when Super Size Me came out. McDonald's were immediately on the back foot, but actually, as a result of what happened, they did. I mean, I'm not saying,
yeah,
I'm not holding them up as a beacon, but
yeah,
they did start to change their practices because they kind of felt that otherwise they were going to lose customers by the,
yeah,
sound of it.
And I mean, they have added some healthier items to their menu.
It's apparently you can buy some salad.
That's right, but the truth is, they still earn the overwhelming majority of their profits selling the same old food.
And I was going to say, what about the fact that in the case of the film of Fast Food Nation, that the idea that you have to dramatize this story, you have to not do it as a documentary? Because I talked to Linklater about it, and he said, well,
yeah,
the point is, if you're getting that, his point was, if you make actually, I think he was saying exactly the kind of documentary as Food Inc. The problem is you're not going to get a mainstream audience in. Therefore, what you do is you make something with Bruce Willis, with you know, Avril, I mean, with people that they know, in order to kind of to disguise what you're doing, and then you slip in. I mean, what do you think about that argument?
Well, Rick is a dear friend, and I think he's a wonderful director, and I really like the film, the feature film that he made, Fast Food Nation. I think there's no one way to address the subject. I mean, in the sense that that film was Richard Linklater's vision of this world. The documentary is a different director, Robbie Kenner's vision of the same world. You know, you can have somebody who writes a play about the war in Iraq. You can have a film about the war in Iraq. You can have a documentary about the war in Iraq. And it's just, it sounds pretentious, but it's different artists wrestling with the same sort of issues in different ways. And
we've
so,
and we've only got a couple of minutes left, Eric. But I thought about this morning. I watched your film last night, and I went to get a coffee this morning. I'll mention the company. I was in Starbucks, okay? And while I was waiting for it, I looked at a poster, and it said, all coffee used here is fair trade. I think that's interesting, you know. I mean, I know that's not breaking news. That's been there for a while. But stuff changes, doesn't it? Yeah. And presumably that's the power of the consumer saying, hang on, could you make a difference here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, ideally, this film would be empowering to people. Not depressing, but empowering. Because things don't have to be the way they are. And changing it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, going on a starvation diet and only eating pure rice or something like that, by making your desires known through the marketplace, just by choosing to support certain companies, refusing to give money to other companies based on how they behave and based on what they're selling to people, you can make a real difference. And I think it's terrific that Starbucks here is selling fair trade coffee. That's going to have an impact all the way down the production line. And I happen to eat meat still. I've investigated the subject for years, and it hasn't made me a vegetarian. But I think that if you're going to eat meat, you really need to know where it's coming from and try to support the people who are doing it the right way. Here, you know, the McCartneys are supporting Meat Free Monday, which I support as well. I mean, it's all right to give up meat one day a week, eat less of it, but buy the good stuff produced in Great Britain the right way and not the industrial meat that's being shipped from far away. And again, once you see how this industrial meat is being produced, you know, you want to get the real thing, and it's worth paying a little extra for.
And right at the beginning of the film, you say burger and fries has been your favorite meal.
Yeah, it still is. Burger and chips.
Nicely done. I was trying to make you feel at home. Eric Schlosser, thanks very much indeed for coming. I wish you all the best of Food Inc. at the Oscars. Are you going to go?
I hope so.
Got your outfit sorted? Hey, that'll be good. It opens nationwide on the 15th. Eric, thanks very much indeed for coming.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.